feast on this one.
Conceptuality is something other than itself.
There's been a change in the image of thought.
That's what it is.
That's what it is.
That's what it is.
The internal structure of becoming.
As soon as an utterance slips from the mouth, it's divorced from the subject.
So we're continuing, on our Derrida turn from restricted to general economy, a Hegelianism without reserve.
Yes, sir.
And we're going to see if Nate's going to be the Hegel defender.
Clearly I'm going to be at certain moments.
Also, it's not really directed at Hegel. This is all about Bataille, right?
Like, yeah.
Yeah. So it made me want to read Bataille. Like, I can't believe I hadn't read this essay before. Maybe it's just been such a long time because it's so much of what we've talked about over the last few seasons. Like, it's thematized explicitly in this essay.
Mm-hmm.
The inhabitation of Hegel and the slide that the sovereign offers in contrast to lordship. So, like, all of the thematics are directly there. And in many ways, I was like, I didn't really love this essay. Just because it was so direct, right? Like, it was so explicit about its focus on the implicit.
I know what you mean. I wonder, does he deal with Bataille a lot elsewhere? Because, like, he gives Bataille credit here to the point where you think, like, Bataille's the guy. Like, he's the man. Like, there's nobody like him. But I don't remember reading Derrida on Bataille elsewhere. I'm sure he does, but... You know,
but in terms of a sustained engagement, that's the other thing. It made me kind of want to go read Bataille, because I had read Bataille back in grad school, and the version of Bataille that I got was this sort of commitment to transgression, which was also a commitment to the limit, and I didn't really, I didn't find that terribly interesting. Yeah, like the preface to transgression thing that Foucault wrote, like it also makes me want to go back and reread that essay because I'm like, hey, maybe there's...
That's a pretty good essay.
There's other stuff going on. I haven't read that in 20 years, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But also to read more Bataille, like, because back then I read, like, The Story of the Eye, which is a novel, and like, The Accursed Chair, I think. And there was... It just didn't really click for me because I just associated him with this, like I said, this transgressive Sadean version. And it's like, what you have here is a much more supple version of...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's transgression here, but it's not simply the overcoming of limits that reestablishes other limits, right? Like, and that the moment at the end, I think, is really interesting, where he's like, I'm going to read Bataille against Hegel, which is also against Bataille, because Bataille doesn't read himself against Hegel here, you know?
Right.
So there's that the interesting way in which it seems like a lot of what he sees Bataille as doing is directed at Hegel, or at least though Bataille might have seen it as a following out of a Hegelian thinking, he sees it as kind of a slide away, not a stiff arming, and certainly not a negation, but an attempt to slide away. So, I mean, there's something to be said in terms of the intellectual history that, you know, you've remarked on before, Boo Boo, about, like, you know, something happens in the 60s where there's this whole group of folks that are like Hegel bad, and for whom, you know, Bataille as a little bit earlier thinker is not really part of that, right? He doesn't feel like he has to attempt to distance himself.
Although it does seem like Bataille's inclination to read within Hegel is partially because, at least this is the way that I'm taking Derrida's gloss on it, is that Bataille recognizes that to try to stiff arm Hegel is precisely to get caught up in the dialogue. Like, if you can't oppose or negate or engage Hegelianism within the figure of the dialectic. Or discourse, and so the only thing that he can do is inhabit Hegel and then introduce a kind of laughter or a kind of comedy where, like, I mean, you know, one of the things that Derrida returns to over and over again is the labor or the work of the negative and of the seriousness, and it seems like what Bataille does is point out the comedy or the laughter, not to distance oneself from Hegel and laugh at it, which is exactly what Derrida accuses more recent followers of Bataille of doing, but to intimately immerse oneself in it and then allow Hegel to laugh at itself. And it seemed like that a point of laughter that emerges is at the catch 22 of the master or of the Lord itself, who in order to establish itself as Lord must become subject to the recognition of the slave. And that becomes the version of the negative, which is a domestication of the absolute negative or of absolute erasure. So it's the harnessing of the negative to create something positive, but then also, too, the positive that is created, a recognized identity as a recognition of lordship, becomes kind of hilarious because it's very clearly, like, it's a lord only through the possibility of servitude to the need of recognition.
Right. Well, it's sort of a vulgar fool's game. Like, if all you're after is identity and mastery, you know, with the sort of constitutive failure, like, the whole ethic is resentment, basically, like, in Nietzsche's terms. So this laughter would be in service of redirecting that ethos or ethic in some way. And I think Derrida is interesting on this within the 60s and 70s here because, like you said, Nathaniel, he basically says you need to inhabit Hegel's text in order potentially to transform or redirect that ethic or ethos, which makes him clearly different from Deleuze, who basically wants a total detachment. Like he wants something violent. Like we need to completely shove this down and foster sort of a Nietzschean affirmation. And Foucault is sort of more in that vein as well. So Derrida is, I wouldn't say more complex, he's just taking a different line, where it's like...
Well, he's inhabiting Bataille, who inhabits right. Hegel. So, I mean, like, this is like the most Derridian thing I feel like you can do, inhabit the inhabiter.
What's weird about this particular essay, though, is that he stresses at the beginning, like, there's this menacing influence of Hegelianism that you have to inhabit in order to potentially to transform. And then I feel like, he's mostly just inhabiting Bataille's text or Bataille's version of Hegel. I don't see a lot of inhabiting Hegel here. I see kind of in a lot of places a caricature of Hegel, which again is not a problem in itself, but it's weird because elsewhere Derrida is like in Gla, is like his text is imperceptible to the point where, like, you don't even know who's talking. Is it Hegel talking? Is it Derrida? Where's the interventions? Like, so this is, like, pretty... Like, the intervention is clear. Hegel's the restricted economy. Bataille and my version of Bataille and Hegel against Hegel, that's the general economy. So it's, like, there's pretty clear demarcations in this essay.
Yeah. And a pretty clear distinction or difference between Hegel, Bataille's Hegel, Derrida's Bataille's Hegel.
Yeah. Right, right.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, it's also important to say that clear distinction between the restricted and the general economy isn't a distinction, right? Like, I mean, it's not like there's one that is subordinate to, you know, the other or just a smaller case. But it is the way that we've talked about it, the impossibility of rendering this non-relation, you know, and because there isn't a thing called the general economy, right? Like it's like this whole essay is about différence, you know, or as in the word here is sovereignty, right? Like that's
thinking and sovereignty at the beginning,
right? Yeah. As différence. So there's a, I mean, cause I didn't really, I mean, to me, I, my sense in reading this was he's just trying to think through what Bataille is doing. Right, like that's it. And so Bataille has chosen this path of engaging Hegel in this way, and Derrida finds it fascinating because where you get to is that you can't simply inhabit, right? Like that there's, you're not going to have a sense of the distinctions between the inhabiter and the inhabited, right? And all you can do is produce these like words, you know, that don't make sense, but not because they are a terrain of non-meaning. So there's a way here, for me at least, that like Hegel's not a bad guy here. You know, it doesn't seem like it. It's like the bad guy is, and this is the thing that you say all the time, Boo Boo, is like the bad guy is the kind of consciousness that drives value, that drives meaning, that like organizes the whole thing that Hegel has so totalizingly mapped out and is so fucking right about. And so to that extent, we'll never be done with reading Hegel. And yet there's something else, you know, but there's not a something else, right? Like you always have to do those provisional things. There isn't an alternative to Hegel, and certainly not a negation. But in that sense, it's like Hegel as the diagnostician of consciousness is like totally spot on, right? Yeah.
It doesn't seem like Hegel's the bad guy, but it certainly seems like Hegel discovered the bad guy, which sounds like a very Nate thing to say.
Right, that's right. Constant
he articulates reminder. The bad guy. Yeah.
Right.
But it terrifies.
He just becomes the name for it. Like the Hegelian phenomenology just becomes the name for subjectivity, consciousness, the reserve, you know, holding in reserve that little bit of the, you know, the bet.
Right.
Right. Like as we were talking about of like the value bet.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing that I really took issue with was the intervention where basically there needs to be a point of contention here for this essay to work, where he says it several times where like there's a blind spot in Hegel, or there's like Hegel didn't read his own revelation, like that kind of like he didn't realize his own genius at certain moments in the text. And I just feel like it doesn't really matter. I mean, like you pick a target and that's the target, but I feel like there's so many points where Hegel's spirit or absolute spirit or several of his concepts in some way that they basically point to Derrida's version of laughter here or the sovereign. But here it's posed as like the sovereign is like the blind spot that Hegel couldn't quite get to, like lordship.
Hold on, I got to jump in because Nate was almost smiling full blown during that entire monologue because he knew he lost his bet. Unprompted, he just starts defending Hegel against a unarticulated attack.
Right, and the reason I don't agree is simply like the project is what the fuck is Bataille doing with sovereignty, and that's what it is. It's like, and so this concept has emerged as an attempt to rethink lordship, and all of the oppositions to which one can pose to lordship are subsumed under that whole movement. So that's why the thinking of sovereignty as the equivalent of a thinking of difference, like it's a non-concept. Right. It can't do the work of opposing Hegel, which is honestly to me, that's what the essay is sort of about. Is like, hey, here's a really deft effort on Bataille's part, who realizes, unlike many, that you can't critique Hegel, and that you don't need to, right? And so in that sense, it's a weird celebration of Bataille's non-intervention, right? Well, it's not weird, but I think that's what it is. It is this, like, Bataille has offered us a thinking that allows for, you know, something else that's not other, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And that can't go anywhere, and that can't have a following, that can't produce a discourse, that can't become difference, even, right? Like.
Right. Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say that one of the things that was just sort of hanging in the back of my head from about the halfway point until the end was just, and it was actually in our last season on Heidegger and Heidegger's reading of Nietzsche as resentment again, as the vengeance against life or vengeance against becoming. And it strikes me that, you know, as we've talked about Hegel being a thinker of movement over and over and over again, and it's really more of a sort of like the style of that movement. But in reading this, what was sort of dangling in front of me for a long time was just that how important the function of recognition is for the movement of the master-slave dialectic, or just the movement of the dialectic itself, that negation is a reifying moment that is then in service of a kind of movement, or is in service of a kind of production, but it needs to create stilted snapshots of something. It needs to have a status or a being recognized. Now, that the recognition of that being is always a failure, which then is going to move the machine. But it just provides a very different orientation to the very question of movement itself, which is to say, like, the question seems to be more this: how does being move, or how does being change? But you start with being and then think it within an always failed being that allows it to move. And it just seemed like so much of the, I mean, you know, Derrida, about three quarters of the way through, maybe halfway through, it's when he really starts to talk about the language of recognition. And then about three quarters of the way through, about like just the thing about that the sovereign is, has no need for recognition. It has no need for, in fact, it cannot, in order to be sovereign, it cannot be subordinate to anything else, and it cannot seek to subordinate, including to itself, including to its own presence. It can only...
That's, you know, like, the second part is the crucial part, yeah.
Right.
The far more important part, because that's where, you know, John, you're using the language of difference here, which I think is right. Yeah. I wrote that in the margins. But just to stick within the other language, of just becoming.
Yeah.
As well, as in the not incomplete state of being, but as the ever self-overcoming, or the ever self-transformative, never through a mechanism of negation or failed recognition, or better yet to say, like, insufficient recognition. And then, you know, the question of the movement of becoming is just a different question than the movement of being, because it seems to me that the movement of being is always subject to something like the paradox of, like, Zeno's paradox is... When you begin with a snapshot image of time and beings, it seems like movement is never actually possible, except for in the negative relief. You can recognize a difference between this state and that state, but the internal structure of becoming is its own movement. Whereas it seems like you have to get to movement by a much sort of clumsier route, which is, by the way, the only route by which understanding has to move itself, but that's only if you're beginning from the need or the drive to understand the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, my own, again, this is why I didn't want to defend Hegel here, because it's not necessary. Like, there's not a real point in, like, trying to uphold his version, because I think the intervention is in some ways sort of necessary and super interesting, and I think really relates to, like, a lot of our conversations about the Overman, as well as this potential ethical transformation that has to necessarily remain enigmatic and strange and a little bit mysterious without, you know, lapsing into mysticism, because it's like we said over text, like, if you were to comprehend the Overman, or even attempt to comprehend the Overman or sovereignty, you would just fall back into the Hegelian system of, you know, comprehension, recognition, representation, all of that stuff.
The sovereign would become the Lord.
Right, right. It would just fall back into lordship.
But you also can't just abandon the project.
Right,
of, like,
exactly.
Well, it's just this thing that's in excess in relationship to knowledge, right? That's hence the sort of produce more words.
And it's thoroughly systematic the way that Derrida makes this intervention through Bataille. It's not just some careless, like, well, we have laughter, we're going to laugh at Hegel. It's not just, it doesn't just stop at,
oh, it's not, it's laugh not laughing. Hegel. It's definitely not laughing at.
No,
right?
No,
like,
no.
It's definitely not that.
But again, the only slight thing, just for the purposes of my project, you know, this doesn't necessarily, like, I'm not asking you guys to have this thought, but it seems like a lot of people, in order to make this intervention into Hegel, they kind of, you have to stop at the lordship and bondage section, right? I mean, like, there's other, like, they're not, he's not necessarily interrogating spirit or absolute spirit. And again, I'm not saying he has to, but Hegel doesn't necessarily celebrate the understanding or the Lord, right? I mean, like, eventually, as we all know, the truth of self-consciousness is found in the position of servitude, right? So it's like, it's this whole recursive, really weird, circuitous process that gets us back to this, like, ground level. And I think you could argue that Hegel does offer something similar to sovereignty. Now, it's not that. It's not what Derrida is saying. It's not the overman. Hegel's not offering some potential transformation of the dynamics of subjectivity. He's basically saying you don't get to get out of it, right? So that's the key difference between Hegel and Nietzsche, Hegel and Derrida, Hegel and Foucault, is that the French continental tradition is attempting to do something different. But I think that in some places they're not giving him enough credit. Like, it seems like what they're saying is, like, the lordship and bondage section, like, that's the entirety of the phenomenology. Or that the understanding, right, the dynamics of the understanding, that's the whole thing. Whereas, like, as we've said, he's diagnosing the understanding. It's not just a celebration of subjectivity or resentment. It's like saying, like, this is, to some extent, an inescapable structure of thinking or being. Here's how we can deal with it. But it's not a full endorsement. It's not a full-throated endorsement of those dynamics. I don't think.
I agree. Yeah. And I think that Derrida and potentially even Bataille agree with that as well. But I do think that it's fair to say then, though, that the human subjectivity, consciousness, understanding, knowledge are just pseudonyms for the mechanism of revenge against life as becoming.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, I think that you're right, Nate, insofar as that sort of then lays out the field or the problematic of human existence.
Yeah, I would say it this way, like, it's like, so what if Hegel's right? Right. Yeah. Like, I mean, that the critique is this, and that, I mean, it's like, what does being right get you? Right?
Right.
What does correctly diagnosing the movements of consciousness, which, like, all of these folks are granting, like, so what? Mm-hmm. And what does that offer? And that's the project for Hegel, right? Like, that that's, like, mm-hmm. we're going to understand the whole movement of, you know, not just understanding, but the whole emergence of spirit through its various steps. And I think the idea here is, again, like, so, like, that's a philosophical project.
Mm-hmm.
And that what they're interested in is not a non-philosophical. That's why he does that work on the poetic at that one point, sort of early on, because that's, like, what Heidegger does. You kind of want to say, like, Heidegger should have pre-read his Bataille, right? Like, that, you know, you got to do work on the poetic, because simply saying, look at the, you know, figural iterative dimensions of the poetic, it's like, versus the concept, that's not going to do it. That's fully subsumable in that oppositional matrix. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, it actually is about having to inhabit the philosophical language,
right?
Which is what Bataille says. I mean, there's that one chunk in there where he's like, I have to talk philosophy, though it's not the right language. And it's like, yeah, that's the game. And that's where, I mean, whatever, Bataille ends up sounding really Derridian to me in this regard. But one of the stakes of that, I think, really is, and it's really hard, I think, for each of us in different ways to get our heads around this, is that Hegel's not a good guy or a bad guy or even a neutral guy, right? Like, he, at a certain level, he's not any particular thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's one kind of engagement. And that's where, to me, that offering the different style of engagement, I think the underlying question is, what's so great about being right about diagnosing the movement of consciousness? Like,
or
why is it overrun by a kind of representational ethos? Must be adequate to the thing? It's like, no, it doesn't have to be.
Right.
Well, and how do you... That's the entire driving force. I mean, just at the level of the title from Restricted to General Economy, is that, like, within a restricted economy, where, by the way, the restriction is marked by the necessity of conscious recognition. I mean, that ends up being the sort of the core value that is held
on. But we should also acknowledge that the restricted economy comprises all of being. right? Like, yeah, yeah. Like everything, yeah. Every thought, yeah. Every movement, everything. Like
anything that could ever be, anything that could ever be considered a being.
Right.
Yeah. And by the way, even more than that, anything that can be rendered as a being.
Right. Concepts, right? Words, language, yeah. People, yeah. Yes. Like everything. Right. So that, I mean, the terminology is a little like, because restricted sounds like, well, it's a narrow area and the general thing is more broad. It's like, it's not
all
more broad.
All of ontology, all of metaphysics, right? Right. So yeah, it's quite large, but it's still a...
It's everything.
Yeah.
Everything, yes. Everything.
Everything.
Yes. Right.
But the importance there is that...
Even movement.
Everything, yeah, even movement in terms of its sort of like discreteness and its steps and its, right? Everything is rendered according to a restricted economy or according to, you know, the machinery of subjective consciousness and understanding. And yet that is still, despite how large it is, that is still not the only economy. That is one operation. I would even say one rhetorical operation among others. Now you can the frustrating thing about all of the other kinds of machineries and economies is that they don't produce things, which means you can't articulate them as beings, which means that you can't think about you can't recognize them as understanding or knowledges. Like, and even, you know, even in my pronouns, I can't start talking about them as thems, but it is still like there is still that general economy that, you know, in this essay is the sovereign. But you could also just call it, you know, the performativity or invention,
illocutionary force,
right.
difference.
Well, but the paradox also is that Derrida's version of sovereignty here, or difference, whatever, it's framed as an ontological condition, almost like a fact, like this is how life works. But it's like this intimate thing, but it's also something that's like so far on the horizon that you can't even begin to conceptualize it or internalize it.
Well, because
as soon as you start talking about recognizing or internalizing it, then you've subjected it to being. And I think part of it, I think part of the language of the general, the restricted to general economy is the recognition that the restricted economy is one rendering or one modality of a general economy, right? Yeah, so
it's one way of inhabiting general economy, which is sort of the ontological baseline.
The weird thing about the restrictive economy is it takes everything as its object. Right. So when the restricted economy takes the general economy as its object, it renders itself in its own image becoming as being. So like you have to look at it from both ways, is that being is nothing more than a rhetorical configuration of becoming. And then yet being's jam is to render and configure becoming.
And you could
say that's why it's like, look, the restricted economy is only possible because, or being is only possible because of a becoming. So, but becoming the sovereign is a condition of possibility for the Lord, for being. But on the other hand, when you're talking about becoming or sovereignty from the perspective of being, that's why it can only be this thing out there on the horizon that you would call futurity or the overman.
Right. You'll never be able to be it, and you'll never be able to even point to it.
Exactly.
Right. Like, there it is. There's some sovereignty.
From the perspective of that restricted economy of being, by the way, is the only economy capable of pointing.
That you can.
It's the only economy capable of pointing, right? Or demarcating, or...
Well, and you could say, you could also maybe say that the restricted economy is a symptomatic collective response to the dynamics of the general economy. But that doesn't mean that you get out of it. It's equally constitutive at that point. Right. Once you're in the restricted economy, there's no clear route out of it.
Because in it is us as subjects, as conscious subjects, knowing subjects, right?
And this is why I think... go ahead.
It was striking to me, there was one moment in there where he says that sovereignty is not even the condition of possibility. And that's often the terminology he uses in other places. And this is like 67, right? This is early. And, you know, a lot of times you think of Derrida as the condition of possibility, like non-knowledge is the condition of possibility. It's like, it's not even the condition of possibility. It's not like there's a background affirmation of sovereignty that allows negation to work, right? Like, it's not even that. It's literally nothing. And that's, I mean, here's the thing where I think that, you know, you're hard-pressed, at least to me, you're hard-pressed to make Hegel into a thinker who is attempting to attend to that, right? Like, it's just not the project, right? Like, and for someone like Bataille, it is. And for someone like Derrida, it is. And that doesn't, that's not to say that you can't find that thing in Hegel. It's just that the direction and the focus and the disposition is one that's just a different kind of disposition. Like, what are the rules of the game, right, is like Hegel's question. And he has so dramatically and perfectly answered it through movement of negation that there's no alternative. And yet the rules of the game come from somewhere. That's even too strong of a word. It's not like there's an origin point, but that's not all there is. Or rather, it is all there is. But
you could facilitate a transformation, potentially. And that's sort
of what... Well, it's not even it wouldn't even be a transformation. Like, that's where, to me, it's sort of like, this isn't a overman, like, we'll get there one day. Like, we don't get there.
No,
there's no there.
But there's still a project.
But what you have is the inducing of a non-laughing laughter within the Hegelian discourse, right? Like, that's all we're doing is these, like, chuckling moments where we're not laughing at. We're just like, this shit's fucking crazy, right? Like, that's it. That's
Or we're laughing at ourselves. I mean, I mean, one thing about Hegel is it can become intimately personal and, you know, sort of like the laughing... The I laughing at itself for its desire for recognition at the moment of recognizing its impossibility.
Right, and the preservation.
And the servility that it requires. Yeah, the the desire to preserve myself is the desire for my death.
That's right. Right. Exactly. I mean, that's where the end thing where he does this stuff, the sort of contra Hegel, you know, in quotation marks contra. But like he rewrites that image of, like, through the glance or whatever, through the visibility, he rewrites that image of preserving one's life, right? Like, that one must risk one's life, but obviously in the Hegelian discourse, the Lord must risk his life to be Lord, but he also has to live through it. And that's the moment of laughter. It's like, we know how this game works, right? It's about... And for me, what was really helpful was to realize... The problem with the movement of the Aufhebung isn't really negation so much. It's the sublation move. It's the maintaining as well as overcoming. Right, the preservation component.
Because it doesn't allow itself actually to be sheer negation or absolute negation.
Well, it
needs
wants
to like
out of
time
the game.
Capsule. Because if you actually did that, right, then I mean, because any moment of the dialectical machinery requires the stabilization of that which has been sublimated in order for it to persist. If it were a sheer negation, then, you know, if the sophists were just simply negated, there's no Socrates.
Right.
Right. Yeah. But that's another one of the paradoxes. I mean, like, even, you know, at a biological level, like, in order to persist as an identity, you have to be constitutively open to the ruptures of alterity, to the outside. So there is no final preservation of self, even if that is the explicit telos of understanding of
that's
master.
Right.
It cannot have that telos as its ontological condition, even if that's the sort of, I don't know what you would call it, not a subjective telos, but like, even if that's the mechanism where understanding wants totality or the master wants security and invulnerability, right? The only way for that to work, for him to persist is actually to be open to death.
To be vulnerable.
Right. Yeah, and to be vulnerable. So that's just another one of those cute little Hegelian paradoxes.
Right. This is more in the spirit of Nietzsche's On Truth and Lying in a Non-Moral Sense, is that it just gives you a particular vantage point on how silly or trivial or odd or derivative or unlikely this drive toward truth or this machinery of the faculty of understanding is from the perspective of life. Of right? Because this is, none of this is a problem for life, right? Because there is no, identity is not a problem for life, because they're just straight up no identities. Like, what does it mean for there to be an identity outside of recognition or understanding? And I was like, that's just like a non-starting term. And then to then like say, like, all right, well, you know, understanding seems to want this. It's like, mm-hmm. yeah, understanding and nothing else. Nothing other than this little peculiar, almost sort of like a appendix or like derivative effect of an otherwise purely affirmative world of becoming. It's like, I want to understand things. And, you know, like part of, you know, the operation of the podcast, and, you know, I imagine this is the operation of all our listeners as well, is like our drive toward that is this kind of insatiable, life-sustaining curiosity. But I think that's a relatively late interpretation of the understanding. Like the interpretation of understanding by curiosity is a relatively late appropriation, mm-hmm. a relatively late interpretation, because I'd be with Heidegger on this, is that the desire to understand is the desire to fix, to dominate, to forestall death, which is to forestall its own life. And, you know, like the very opposition between life and death is a false opposition. Presumes right. that things are there to live and things are there to die, whereas becoming, you know, the concept of becoming has no real use for the very notion of a dead thing or a living thing. Mm-hmm. It's only ever life death.
Right. I mean, this just comes back to the dynamics of resentment as well. Like, if the dominating impulse of all modern humanity is this sort of life depreciating, controlling drive, you know, then the enemy, like we've been saying, would be the human. Not necessarily Hegel himself, although Hegel's certainly included, but the enemy would have to be like the entirety of our mode of engagement, our collective mode of engagement, you know, since whenever, since maybe even the Greeks, or, you know, since we've been reading since the dawn of history. Like, so how, I mean, my only question, the reason I'm invested in this, in Hegel's project, as opposed to, or, you know, alongside Derrida's and Foucault's, is that, like Derrida says at the beginning, a lot of people just want to kind of skip past it. Like, okay, the Hegel thing, that's like scary, and I don't know, I feel like we've kind of gotten past that shit. So let's move on to, like, you know, relational ontologies, because that seems progressive, and maybe that can foster a better ethical, you know, engagement with the world. So it seems like, you know, in the reach past a lot of the times, you know, even if it's implicit, even if you're not mentioning Hegel, you're like going, you're not only not going past Hegel, you're going like five steps behind him, and you're getting caught in like some pre-Kantian thing where like
Derrida is really, he's like turning the page on that. Philosophy usually amounts to philosophizing badly.
Right.
In other words, thinking that you've got the new thing, and we've talked about, obviously, even the phrase relational ontology doesn't make sense, right? Like, you have to do some work on, like, well, if relations have a being, then you've given up the whole relations. Function that you introduced relations for in the first place. But whatever. I mean, the flip side of another way of saying the thing that Nathaniel was saying a second ago, to which you responded, is like, if that's all there is, that kind of resentful sort of setting mm-hmm. of, that's also not all there is, which is to say the whole thing is also that silent laughter in the midst of, you know, like, so it's also that, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just this sort of negative deprecating, life deprecating thing. It is also, so that negative life deprecation, this is where I find Nietzsche really helpful. That negative life deprecation is a form of life, right? Mm-hmm. It's a form of will to power. It's just a different kind of life. So it's like, you know, what Derrida is doing here is he's like, you know, hunting down and highlighting the laughing quality, mm-hmm. right? Like, yeah. And that's, to mm-hmm. me, different than Hegel, right? Like, yeah. that's just a different disposition. That doesn't mean that they are, you know, fundamentally, or that they're even opposed, or that one doesn't create the room for the other. That's a different disposition. And honestly, I think that that's the whole aversion to Hegel thing is...
Well, I think, like, that there's a tragedy to, or a sadness, or a somberness, or a burden of life for Hegel to carry, in the impossibility of, like, this moment that Bataille and Derrida are calling a moment of laughter. It seems more like Hegel's response to it is a sigh and keep the machinery running. And yeah, perhaps to elevate one's consciousness of it to, like some kind of absolute conscious, where I am conscious of, or I understand the mechanism of the understanding, and then I just sort of more or less resign myself to it. But, you know, like, let's say, you know, I mean, to do a faux genealogy here, that the mechanism of the understanding is at its genesis, or at a point of appropriation, interpretation, whatever, is a resentment against life out of a fear of death. Mm-hmm. Let's say that's the case. In Nietzsche, you find, I think, a different appropriation of this will toward understanding, or this will, this thing called thinking, which is curiosity, which is not a desire for stabilization, even if there's a recognition that stabilization is impossible, but to embrace the thing as just another modality of life, and to then lighten it, to make it gay, to make it to make it a matter of laughing, where the next step isn't because of a failure or an insufficiency of the last step.
Here's my only, this would be my other defending Hegel point, is that I think when I read Hegel, I read someone who is so absorbed in the complexity of the discourse, right? Like you say, like, language speaks him. Like, it you can feel when you read him, the language is like doing its own work. And I think there is a joy to that, even if it's always inflected with sort of like seriousness, labor, dread, anxiety, right? A lot of it is negatively inflected or intonated, but I don't find him particularly invested in the stability of meaning or the stability of representation, even if those are articulated as symptoms of a couple of those key faculties, like the understanding or reason. I find the work explicitly invested in, like, you know, like with Derrida stuff, like sort of incoherence, uncertainty on an ontological level, like, and so I feel like he's playing in a way that maybe he doesn't even recognize, where it's, you know, but it doesn't matter, where it's like the text becomes so complex and so unwieldy, but that to me is like a productive unwieldiness. It's not for Hegel, I don't think that produces anxiety. I don't think he's like, we gotta tame the uncertainty of existence. He's following that thread to the point where it is like, it would be scary for some people, and I'm sure it is scary for Hegel, but I think he makes that step, that leap, more often than not, than Derrida in this essay gives him credit for.
Right, where it's so you, like, just need to write, you know, the essay called, or the book called Hegelian Laughter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Let me also say, I don't doubt what you're saying, and I don't think that what you just said is incompatible with what Derrida's doing here with Bataille. I really don't. No. Like, because you really would have to say there isn't a Hegel. Like, one unified, like, there isn't a Hegel. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it becomes an index for something, but that's, again, the project of, like, so, you know, the question that I would pose to you is, like, all right, I believe thoroughly that that can be done and is available to be done, not simply by external work, it's available interior. So why do it, right? Like, why do that instead of doing it to Barad? It seems like in order to do that, you require these people who are reading Hegel badly, right? Like, you create a different kind of sounding board against which you can revert to the positive or affirmative Hegel, or the Derrida's, or, you know. So in each case, it's just a matter of, like, and I think that's Bataille's point. It's like, that's the only game. That's the only way of engaging is by saying, well, it's not this, and it's not that, and it's not this other thing, you know?
Right, right.
So, is it possible in that case to say, I'm interested in Hegelian laughter, but not because nobody else sees it, and not because everyone takes him to be somber and full of work and labor, right? Like, so the need to position it against something else is sort of, you know, it's part of the same game.
I mean, the more I read all of, like, Foucault, Deleuze on Hegel, even when it's indirect, when they're just talking about, you know, humanism or dialectics, I find it to be like a pragmatic cut, like where it's like, I'm not going to take offense to it. Like, I don't think Hegel would, or why would he? Like, they had to make an intervention because of whatever, because of the pressures of the moment, because of that particular cultural moment, because philosophy was, maybe they saw it hitting some sort of dead end, right? So they felt a pressure and they made a decision. And it just so happened that Hegel, for a few of these people, happened to be that hinge in order to kind of launch the post-structuralist project, or the variations of that project. So I don't think that you don't need to defend, you don't need to be like, I got to recover Hegel from this attack, you know, because it was like that attack served its purpose in that moment. And I don't think it's unjustified. You know, it wasn't
and unjustified. I mean, that's where, to me, like, you know, what Deleuze says of Nietzsche in the Nietzsche book is, like, Nietzsche introduces a different tone into philosophy. That's it, right? Like, and it's a tone of play. And it's not that Hegel's not funny. It's just a question of, like, well, which sitcom do you like? This, you know, this sitcom versus that sitcom. And that's the sort of singular offering of any post-Hegelian, or Plato. We could have everything that we said in terms of Hegel, we could talk about in terms of Plato as another one of those, you know, massive figures who encapsulates all things.
Yep.
But, you know, for me, for instance, why would Plato be a more Plato would be a more interesting figure to go to, simply because when I read it and I read the dialogues, it's funny, right? Like, it's that fucking simple, right? It's smart ass and funny. That is not to say that there's not humor in Hegel. I just don't have the coordinates for it, like, jumping off the page at me, right? Like, and whatever. That's just a different way. I mean, neither are better.
He's not laugh out loud funny. I'll tell you that. You're not going to be just, you know, slapping your knee, just cracking up reading Hegel. It's not going to happen. Well, you can do that. You will do that with Nietzsche, though. I mean, like, it's like totally different writers. Like, just completely different sensibilities, you know. And it's almost like one is still, like, Hegel almost reads like somebody who, it's almost like autistic, like the, like, you know what I mean? Like, just the drive and the precision, but then the kind of weird, like, sometimes lack of self-awareness of his own tone, right? Like, where he just shits on people and whole movements of thought. And, but, so it's like, and Nietzsche's like this, like, a modern figure. Nietzsche is a particularly modern figure with humor that holds up to, like, modern standards of humor, whereas Hegel's, like, just in this other era where he's like, he's kind of just caught in this moment where he's not quite as accessible to sort of a modern sensibility. But again, I don't think that means, like you're saying, I don't think that means you couldn't do that sort of similar work with him.
Give me coordinates for reading Hegel. I mean, I'm fine with that. Like, it's, I mean, another way of saying this is that the level of the content, there really isn't that much difference between, you know, the Hegelian movement and the Nietzschean movement. And I actually totally agree with that, right? Like, that's why I'm writing a book on style, is, like, you know, that notion is, it's like that seems to be deeply important, and it's not anything that you can point to, where he's like, see, there's Hegel being serious again, right? Like, you know, and I totally get, the different types of comedy in that regard. It's like there's...
Right.
I would want to say, like, well, what do these folks have to say about comedy? But that's one thing, right? Like, what does Hegel say about laughter? I don't have any idea.
Right. You know, I'm not even sure. I mean, the way Derrida frames it, it's like he doesn't even address it. Like, there's just not... There's literally no instance of talking of joy or laughter in the Hegelian system. And I mean, yeah, that is true. I mean, it's sort of like Hegel's writing a tragedy, right? I mean, it is, it's somber, it's sort of full of dread and anxiety. And those are the words, you will see those exact words throughout the phenomenology. Right. You see dread, you'll see anxiety. You will never see the word laughter, I don't think, or like, that's funny or what, you know what I mean? So, so yeah, you are right. I mean, the styles are, I don't know, like, what does that mean, though? Like, what do you draw from the fact that the styles of engagement are sort of diametrically opposed, even if the content or the terrain is similar?
You know, I mean, like, it's just a recognition recognition of difference. And it is just sort of, and I use each of those words, recognition of difference. And also just to sort of like, hey, here are the playlists, and there are different ones that are going to hook in different ways for different ways of living, different dispositions. So it's like, and so for me, there isn't, it's kind of like, well, there are some nights that I want to listen to shoegazing emo music, and there are some nights where I want to listen, you know, like, not that it's simply a question of subjective choice either, but it's just a kind of dispositional inclinations. It's a way of just saying, like, all of these things that we do are simply expressions of styles that are formed in the relations of the things we do, right? Like, so we reproduce a kind of labor of negativity that one can find, like, even in Hegel, and we reproduce that as an operation going forward. Like, we are acting in the world when we read Hegel as the purveyor of the negative, in some small way, right? Like, and there are other ways of doing that. You know,
right?
And one can do it with Hegel, or one can just read a different book.
I'd want to go a little bit further than just the different playlists. And sometimes I like to listen to emo or hardcore, or jazz, or whatever else. Because, like, well, I mean, or I want to stick with that metaphor a bit more, because habituating oneself within those genres of music makes different worlds, makes different kinds of life as well. And one thing that I see in Hegel that I prefer to avoid is a kind of suffocating, totalizing answer for everything that only really leaves labor and somberness available. Like, I don't think that he chooses those things as, like, his preferred go-to. It's like, after he eradicates all other possibility and direction, that's what else is left. And what I love about, I mean, about Deleuze and Nietzsche for sure, but we were talking about Plato, is there's an agility in Plato's thinking where it seems like he is a lover of wisdom, and that he's constantly chasing whatever, he's running off in whatever direction that he's been sort of catalyzed to head in, and then, you know, like, then turns on a dime to go somewhere else based on someone's response or based on the introduction of some other new thing.
He's like the Steph Curry of concepts.
He's the Steph Curry of concepts, for sure. Hegel is Shaq. Where it's just like, this shit is inevitable. I don't care if I'm 7'4", Rick Smits, 250 pounds. I'm just going to labor at trying to stop him, knowing that it doesn't matter what I do. He's averaging 36 points a game this series.
Yeah.
I like that you not just ran with it. You, like, took it the next step to give actual numbers from a championship series where the Pacers were getting dominated. Like, everything about that is complete. That's great.
Which is why it was my Hegel example.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. But I also think Hegel is like, well, this is to your point. Like, he's invested in his own conceptual sophistication to the point where it becomes, like, a little bit solipsistic.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting way of saying it, because one of the things that I've always liked about Nietzsche is that he's a sloppy thinker, right? Like, and that's where the Derrida question for me is a harder one, because he's not, right? He's an incredibly precise thinker, right. And yet his precision is invested in the a kind of
play.
Yeah, like I mean, it's a different kind of thing, and that's what I mean. That's why Derrida really appeals to me. I would say the same thing about Deleuze. Like to me, Deleuze is a sloppy thinker, in that good Nietzschean tradition of like, I'm just going to say different shit sometimes and going to contradict myself.
He's not worried about the consistency of his terms. Yeah, or the other way of saying it that he's. Yeah, that he doesn't allow consistency to get in the way of his precision and rigor. Sometimes the word or the term, even though it's been used elsewhere, has to be allowed to become something else. And that actually, that's like either you can look at that as sloppiness or next level precision.
Yeah.
In the same way that you can look at like Steph Curry and be like, all that herky jerkiness is either wasted, sloppy movement, or it's
incredibly
next level efficiency.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. I would maybe put Hegel on terms with like Kawhi at his best. You know, that kind of
thing. I went with Shaq. Like, yeah.
Here's what just happened. Boo Boo ignored the last 5 minutes of our conversation because he wanted to find the right NBA player.
The right player.
You're gonna feast on this one.
Conceptuality is something other than itself.
There's been a change in the image of thought.
That's what it is.
The internal structure of becoming.
As soon as an utterance slips from the mouth, it's divorced from the subject.